They entered the city proper. Here, at least, were the lights they'd seen from out in the bay, pouring from open windows and doors on both sides of the street. The buildings here had started as respectable stone homes and shops, but time and mischief had marked their faces. Broken windows were covered over with planking from ships or scraps of tattered sailcloth. Many of the houses sprouted leaning wooden additions that looked unsafe to approach, let alone live in. Others grew wattle and daub third or fourth stories like mushrooms from their old roofs. Jean felt a sudden pang of grudging nostalgia. Drunkards lying senseless in the alleys, larcenous children eyeing their party from the shadows, maintainers in long leather coats thumping some poor bastard senseless behind a cart with no wheels, the sounds of swearing, argument, laughter, and ale sickness pouring from every open window and door. This place was, if not quite a fraternal relation to Camorre, at least a first cousin.
"Aw, kids!" hollered someone from a second-story window. "Aw, kids!"
Zamira acknowledged the drunken shout with a casual wave and turned right at a muddy crossroads. From the dark mouth of an alley, a heavy-set man stumbled, wearing nothing but soiled breeches. He had the glassy, unfocused eyes of a Jeremite powder smoker, and in his right hand was a serrated knife the length and width of Jean's forearm.
"Coin or suck," said the man,
threads of saliva dangling down his chin.
"Don't care, witch. Got needs. Give us a..."
If he was oblivious to the fact that he was facing eight opponents, he wasn't oblivious to Rask knocking his blade hand aside and shoving him back into the alley by his neck. What happened next took only a few seconds. Jean heard a wet gurgle, and then Rask was stepping back out into the street, wiping one of his own knives on a rag. He threw this rag into the alley behind him and hooked his thumbs into his belt. Ezri and Drakasha seemed to think the incident not even worthy of comment, and they strolled on, casual as temple-goers on Penance Day morning.
"Here we are," said Ezri, as they reached the top of another small hill. A wide, half-paved square, its muddy sections criss-crossed by overlapping wagon tracks, was dominated by a fat, two-story building with a portico constructed around the chopped-off stern facing of an old ship. Time, weather, and no doubt countless brawls had scuffed and chipped its elaborate scrollwork, but people could be seen drinking and reveling behind the second-story windows in what would have been the great cabin. Where the rudder had once been mounted was now a heavy double door flanked by alchemical globes, the round, thick kind that were nearly impossible to break, in an approximation of stern lanterns.
"The tattered crimson," Ezri continued. "It's either the heart of Port Prodigal or the asshole, depending on your perspective."
To the left of the entryway was a ship's longboat, mounted to the building by heavy wooden struts and iron chains. A few human arms and legs seemed to be sticking out of it. As Jean watched, the doors to the tattered crimson slammed outward, and a pair of brutes emerged, carrying a limp old man between them. Without ceremony or pity, they heaved him into the boat, where his arrival caused some incoherent shouting and flailing of limbs.
"Now watch your step," said Ezri, grinning. "Get too drunk to stand, and they throw you overboard. Some nights there's 10 or 20 people piled up in that boat."
A moment later, Jean was squeezing past those brutes, into the familiar smells of a busy tavern at an hour closer to dawn than dinner. Sweat, scalded meat, puke, blood, smoke, and a dozen kinds of bad ale and wine, the bouquet of the civilized nightlife. The place looked to be constructed for a clientele that would be waging war not just on one another, but on the bar and pantry. The bar itself, at the far side of the room, was enclosed from countertop to ceiling by iron panels, leaving only three narrow windows through which the staff could serve drinks and food like archers firing from murder holes. There were only floor tables down here, in the Jureshti fashion, low surfaces around which men and women sat, knelt, or lay on scuffed cushions. In the cave-like fug of the dimly lit room, they played cards and dice, smoked, drank, arm-wrestled, argued, and tried to laugh off the attention of the prowling heavies who were obviously looking for candidates to toss into the boat outside. Conversation wavered as Trakasha's party appeared. Cries of "Orchids!" and "Zamira's back!" could be heard. Trakasha nodded to the room at large and slowly turned her gaze up to the second floor. Stairs went up either side of the common room. At the sides, the second floor was little more than a railed walkway. Above the bar and the entry, it expanded into wider balconies with Therin-style tables and chairs. Jean presumed that the high table was the one he'd glimpsed from the outside. A moment later, Trakasha began to move toward the stairs that led in that very direction. A sudden current of excitement rose in the air. Too many conversations halted absolutely. Too many eyes followed their passage. Jean cracked his knuckles and prepared himself for things to get interesting. Atop those stairs was a railed alcove backed by the windows overlooking the darkened square from which they'd just come. Red silk banners hung in niches with alchemical globes behind them, giving off a low, vaguely ominous rose-tinted light. Two wide tables had been pushed together to accommodate a party of 12, all clearly sailors and toughs, much, Jean realized to his own amusement, like themselves.
"Zamira Trakasha," said the woman at the head of the table, rising from her chair. She was young, roughly Jean's own age, with the sun-browned skin and faint lines edging her eyes that told of years spent on the water. Her sand-coloured hair was drawn back into three tails, and though shorter than Zamira, she looked to outweigh her by about 2 stone. Tough and round, this one, with a well-worn sabre-hilt visible at her belt.
"Rance," said Trakasha. "Che, it's been a long night, love, and you know full well you're sitting at my table.
That's damn peculiar. It's got our drinks on top of it, and our asses in its chairs. You think it's yours. Maybe you should take it with you when you're out of town."
"When I'm away on my business, you mean? Fighting my ship, flying the red flag. You know where the sea is, right? You've seen other captains coming and going."
"I don't have to break myself month in and month out, Trakasha. I just pick richer targets in the first place."
"You're not hearing me, Che. I really don't care what sort of dog gnaws bones at my place when I'm gone," said Trakasha. "But when I come back, I expect her to crawl under the table where she belongs."
Rance's people exploded out of their chairs, and she raised a hand, grinning fiercely.
"Pull steel, you dusty cunt, and I'll kill you fair in front of witnesses. Then the maintainers can haul your crew back to the docks for brawling, and Ezri here can see how your brats like the taste of her tits."
"Show your hand, Rance. You think you're fit to keep this spot?"
"Name the test, and I'll leave you weeping."
"We're going to have the house brutes on us," Jean whispered to Ezri.
"No," she said, waving him to silence. "Calling out isn't like plain brawling, especially not between captains."
"For the table!" shouted Trakasha, reaching for a half-empty bottle. "All the crimson as our witness, the contest is drinks. First on her ass takes her sorry crew and moves down to the floor."
"I was hoping for something that'd take longer than 10 minutes, said Rance. "But I accept. You'll be my guest with that bottle."
Zamira looked around, then snatched 2 small clay cups of equal size from places previously occupied by Rance's crewfolk. She tossed their contents onto the tabletop, then refilled them from the bottle. It was white Kodari brandy, Jean saw, rough as turpentine, packing quite a sting. Rance's crew backed up against the windows, and Rance herself came around the table to stand beside Zamira. She lifted one of the cups.
"One thing," said Zamira. "You're gonna take your first drink Sairun fashion." "What the hell's that?"
"Means you drink it through your fucking eyes.
Drakasha's left arm was a blur as she whipped her own cup from the tabletop and dashed its contents into Rance's face. Before Rance could even scream, Drakasha's right arm came up just as fast. Her gloved fist, rings and all, met Rance's jaw with the sound of a cracking whip, and the younger woman hit the floor so hard the cups atop the table rattled.
"Are you down on your ass down there, love? Or is that your head? Anybody think there's a difference?"
Drakasha stood over Rance and slowly tipped the contents of the second clay cup into her own mouth. She swallowed it all without flinching and tossed the cup over her shoulder.
"You said it was gonna be..."
Before Rance's angry crewman, probably her first mate, could finish his protest, Locke stepped forward with his hand upraised.
"Zamira kept her oath. The test was a drink, and your captain's on her ass." "But..."
"Your captain should have had the wit to be more specific," said Locke. "And she lost. You going to take her oath back for her?" The man grabbed Locke by the front of his tunic. The two of them scuffled briefly and Jean darted forward. But before the situation went to hell, Rance's sailor was hauled back, grudgingly but firmly, by his friends.
"Who the hell are you anyway?"
he shouted.
"Orin Ravel," said Locke.
"Never fucking heard of you."
"I think you'll remember me, though." Locke dangled a small leather pouch in front of the man. "Got your purse, Prickles?"
"You motherfuck!"
Locke gave the purse a hard toss backward, and it landed somewhere down among the 100 or so patrons watching the action on the balcony with eyes wide and mouths open.
"Oops," said Locke. "But I'm sure you can rely on all the upstanding folks down there to keep it safe for you."
"Enough!"
Zamira reached down, grabbed Rance by the collar, and hoisted her to a sitting position.
"Your captain called it, and your captain lost. Is she your captain?"
"Yes,"
said the man, scowling.
"Then keep her oath."
Zamira dragged Rance to the head of the stairs and knelt in front of her.
"Not such a very regal bitch after all, eh, Che?"
Rance reared back to spit blood in Drakasha's face, but the older captain's slap was faster, and the blood spewed out across the stairs.
"Two things," said Zamira. "First, I'm calling the council for tomorrow. I'll expect to see you there at the usual place and time. Nod your silly head."
Rance nodded slowly.
"Second, I don't have brats. I have a daughter and a son. And if you ever forget that again, I'll carve your fucking bones into toys for them."
With that, she heaved Rance down the stairs. By the time she landed in a heap at the bottom, her chagrined crew was hurrying after her under the triumphant stares of Drakasha's party.
"See you around, Orin Ravel,"
said the purseless sailor.
"Valtero," said Zamira sternly, "this was all business. Don't make it personal."
The man looked no happier, but he moved off with the rest of Rance's crew.
"That bit about your children sounded very personal," whispered Jean.
"So I'm a hypocrite," muttered Drakasha. "You want to protest? You can take a drink, Cyrune fashion."
Zamira moved to the rail overlooking the main floor and raised her voice to a shout.
"Zakorin! You hiding down there somewhere?"
"Hiding's the word, Drakasha,"
came a voice from behind the windows of the armored bar.
"War over yet?"
"If you've got a cask of anything that doesn't taste like pig sweat, send it up. And some meat. And Rance's bill. Poor dear needs all the help she can get."
There was an outbreak of laughter across the floor. Rance's crew, carrying her out by her arms and legs, didn't look even vaguely amused.
"So that's that," said Zamira, settling into the chair Rance had just vacated. "Make yourselves comfortable. Welcome to the high table at the Tattered Crimson."
"Well," said Jean as he took a seat between Locke and Ezri, "did that go as you hoped?"
"Oh, yeah,"
Ezri smirked at Drakasha. Yeah, I'd say our flag is flown.
8. They did their best to look relaxed and amused for the better part of an hour, helping themselves to the Crimson's mediocre dark ale and all the better liquors Rance's crew had left behind. Grease-blanketed duck was the dish of the evening. Most of them treated it as decoration, but Rask and Konar gradually brutalized it down to a pile of bones.
"So what do we do now?" asked Locke. "Word'll go out to all the usual vultures that were back in," said Drakasha. "Less than a day or two, and they'll be courting us. Liquor and rations will go first, always easiest to sell. Nautical spares and stores we keep for ourselves. As for the silks and finer things, those independent traders moored at the hospital docks are our friends in that regard. They'll try to clean us out for 15 to 20% of market value. Good enough for us. Then they haul it back across the sea and sell it at full price with innocent smiles on their faces.
What about the messenger?
When she shows up, the shipbreaker will pay us a visit. He'll offer us piss in a clay bowl and we'll talk him up to piss in a wooden jug. Then she's his problem. She's worth maybe 6,000 solari with her rigging intact. I'll be lucky to take him for anything near 2. His crew will take her east and sell her to some eager merchant for about 4, undercutting his competition and carving a fat profit at the same time.
Hell, said Lieutenant Del Mastro. Some of the ships on the Sea of Brass routes have been taken and resold 3 or 4 times.
This shipbreaker, said Locke, feeling a scheme in the berthing. I take it the fact that his trade is also his name means he doesn't have any competitors?
All dead, said Del Mastro, the ugly and publicly instructive way.
Captain, said Locke, how long will all of this take? It's nearly the end of the month, and...
I'm well aware of what day it is, Ravel. It takes as long as it takes. Maybe 3 days, maybe 7 or 8. While we're here, everyone on the crew gets at least 1 chance at a day and night ashore, too.
I haven't forgotten the matter you're concerned about, Drakasha said. I'll bring it to the council tomorrow. After that, we'll see.
Matter?
Del Mastro looked genuinely confused. Locke had been half expecting Jean to have told her by now, but apparently they'd been spending their private time in a wiser and more diverting fashion.
You'll find out tomorrow, Del. After all, you'll be at the council with me. No more on the subject, Ravel.
Right. Locke sipped beer and held up a finger. Something else, then. Let me request a few things of you in private before this shipbreaker comes calling. Maybe I can help you squeeze a higher price out of the fellow.
He's not a fellow, said Drakasha. He's as slippery as a pus-dipped turd and about as pleasant.
So much the better. Think on Master Nera. At least let me make the attempt.
No promises, said Zamira. I'll hear you at least.
Orchids, boomed a deep-voiced man as he appeared at the top of the stairs. Captain Drakasha, you know they're still pulling Rance's teeth out of the walls downstairs?
Rance fell ill with a sudden bout of discourtesy, said Zamira. Then she just fell.
Hello, Captain Rodanoff.
Rodanoff was one of the largest men Locke had ever seen. He must have been just shy of 7 feet. He was about Zamira's age and somewhat round in the belly. But his long, muscle-corded arms looked as though they'd be about right for strangling bears, and the fact that he didn't deign to carry a weapon said much. His face was long and heavy-jawed, his pale hair receding, and his eyes were bright with the satisfied humour of a man who feels himself equal to the world. Locke had seen his type before, among the better garistas of Camor, but none so towering. Even Big Konar could only outdo him in girth. Incongruously, his huge hands were wrapped around a pair of delicate wine bottles made of sapphire-coloured glass with silver ribbons below their corks.
I took 100 bottles of last year's Lashani Blue out of a galleon a few months ago. I saved a few because I knew you had a taste for it. Welcome back.
Welcome to the table, Captain. At Drakash's gesture, Ezri, Jean, Locke, and Konar shuffled one chair to the left, leaving the chair next to Zamira open.
Jafrim settled into it and passed her the wine bottles. When she offered her right hand, he kissed it, then stuck out his tongue.
He said. I always wondered what Chavon would taste like.
He helped himself to a disused cup as Zamira laughed.
Who is closest to the ale cask?
Allow me, said Locke.
Most of you I've met, said Rodanov. Rask, of course. I'm shocked as hell you're still alive. Dantier, Kona, good to see you. Malakasti, love. What Zamira got that I haven't? Wait, I'm not sure I want to know. And you?
He slipped an arm around Lieutenant Del Mastro and gave her a squeeze.
I didn't know Zamira still let children run free on deck. When are you going to reach your growth?
I grew in all the right directions.
She grinned and feigned a punch to his stomach.
You know, the only reason people think your ship's a three-master is because you're always standing on the quarter-deck.
If I take my breeches off, said Rodanov, it suddenly looks as though she's got four.
We might believe that if we hadn't seen enough naked Vadrans to know better, said Drakasha.
Well, I'm no shame to the old country, said Rodanov as Locke passed him a full cup of beer. And I see you've been picking up new faces.
Here and there. Orin Ravel, Jerome Valora. This is Jafrim Rodanov, captain of the Dread Sovereign.
Your health and good fortune, said Rodanov, raising his cup. May your foes be unarmed and your ale unspoiled.
Foolish merchants and fine winds to chase them on, said Zamira, raising one of the wine bottles he'd given her.
Did you have a good sweep this time out?
Holds are fit to bust, said Drakasha, and we pulled in a little brig, about a 90-footer. Ought to be here by now, actually.
That the Red Messenger?
How'd you...
Strozzi came in just yesterday. Said he swooped down on a brig with bad legs and was about to pluck her when he found one of your prize crews waving at him. This was about 60 miles north of Trader's Gate, just off the Burning Reach. Hell, they might be crawling through Trader's Gate as we speak.
More power to them, then. We came in through the parlor.
Not good, said Rodanov, looking less than pleased for the first time since he'd come up. Heard some strange things about the parlor lately. His Eminence, the fat bastard.
Shipbreaker,
Konar whispered to Locke.
Sent a lugger east last month and says it got lost in the storm. But I hear from reliable lips that it never made it out of the parlor.
I thought speed would be the greater virtue coming in, said Drakasha. But next time back, I'll use the gate if it takes a week. You can pass that around.
It'll be my advice, too. Speaking of which, I hear you want to call the council tomorrow.
There's 5 of us in town. I've got curious business from Talvara, and I want a closed meeting.
One captain, one first, said Rodanov. Right, I'll pass the word to Strozzi and Colvard tomorrow. I take it Rance already knows?
Yes.
She might not be able to speak.
She won't need to, said Drakasha. I'm the one with the story to tell.
So be it, said Rodanov. Let us speak behind our hands, lest our lips be read as the book of our designs, and let us find some place where only gods and rats may hear our words aloud.
Locke stared at Rodanov. That was Lucarno from...
The Assassin's Wedding, said Del Mastro.
Yeah, easy, said Rodanov with a grin. Nothing more difficult sprang to mind.
What a curiously theatrical bent you brassy reavers seem to have, said Jean. I knew Ezri had a taste.
I only quote Lucarno for her, said Rodanov. I myself hate the bastard. Mawkish sentiment, obvious self-satisfaction, and so many little puns about fucking so all the Therin Throne's best-dressed twits could feel naughty in public. Meanwhile, the Bonds Magi and my ancestors rolled dice to see who got to burn the Empire down first.
Jerome and I are both very fond of Lucarno, said Del Mastro.
And that is because you don't know any better, said Rodanov. Because the plays of the early throne poets are kept in vaults by pinheads, while Lucarno's merest specks of vomit are exalted by anyone with coins to waste on scribes and bindery. His plays aren't preserved, they're perpetrated. Mercalor Mentezzo.
Mentezzo's all right, said Jean. His verse is fair, but he uses the chorus like a crutch and always throws the gods in at the end to solve everyone's problems.
Mentezzo and his contemporaries built Therin Throne drama from the Espadri model, said Rodanov, invigorating dull temple rituals with relevant political themes. The limitations of their structure should be forgiven. By comparison, Lucarno had their entire body of work to build upon, and all he added to the mix was tawdry melodrama.
Whatever he added, it's enough that 400 years after the scourging of Therin Pell, Lucarno is the only playwright with Talathri's formal patronage whose work is still preserved in its entirety and regularly prepared in new editions.
An appeal to the tastes of the groundlings is not equivalent to a valid philosophical analysis of the works in question. Lucestra of Nicora wrote in her letters to...
Begging everyone's pardon, said Big Konar, but it ain't polite to have an argument if nobody else knows what the fuck you're arguing about.
I have to admit that Konar is right, said Drakasha. I can't tell if you two are about to pull steel or found a mystery cult.
Who the hell are you?
Asked Rodanov, his eyes fixed on Jean.
I haven't had anyone to discuss this with for years.
I had an unusual childhood, said Jean. Yourself?
The prevailing vanity of my youth was that the Therin Collegium needed a master of letters and rhetoric named Rodanov.
What happened?
Well, there was a certain professor of rhetoric, see, who'd come up with a foolproof way to run a betting shop out of the Hall of Studious Reflection. Gladiator pits, collegium boat races, that sort of thing. He used his students as message runners, and since money can be used to buy beer, that made him our personal hero. Of course, when he had to flee the city, it was whips and chains for the rest of us. So I signed on for shit work aboard the merchant galleon.
When was this? Interrupted Locke.
Hell, this was back when the gods were young. Must be 25 years.
This professor of rhetoric, was his name Barsavi? Vencarlo Barsavi?
How the hell could you possibly know that?
Might have crossed paths with him a few times. Locke grinned. Traveling in the east, vicinity of Camor.
I heard rumors, said Rodanov. Heard the name once or twice, but never made it to Camor myself. Barsavi, really? Is he still there?
No, said Jean. No, he died a couple of years ago, is what I heard.
Too bad, Rodanov sighed. Too damn bad.
Well, I can tell I've detained you all for too long, flattering about people who've been dead for centuries.
Don't take me too seriously, Valora. A pleasure to meet you. You as well, Ravel.
Good to see you, Jafrim, said Zamira, rising from her chair along with him. Until tomorrow, then?
I'll expect the good show, he said. Evening, all.
One of your fellow captains, said Jean, as Rodanov descended the stairs. Very interesting. So why didn't he want our table, then?
Dread Sovereign's the biggest ship any Port Prodigal captain has ever had, said Zamira slowly, and she's got the biggest crew by far. Jafrim doesn't need to play the games the rest of us do, and he knows it.
There was no conversation at the table for several minutes, until Rask suddenly cleared his throat and spoke in a low, gravelly voice.
I saw a play once, he said. It had this dog that bit a guy in the balls.
Yeah, said Malakasti. I saw that too. 'Cause the dog loves sausage, and the man is always feeding him sausage, and then he takes his breeches off.
Right, said Drakasha. The very next person who mentions a play of any sort is going to swim back to the orchid. Let's go see how badly our friend Banjit Alvo wanted his silver.
9. Regal woke Locke the next day just in time for the noon watch change. Locke plucked the kitten off the top of his head, stared into his little green eyes, and said,
This may come as quite a shock to you, but there is just no way in all the hells that I'm getting attached to you, you sleep-puncturing menace.
Locke yawned, stretched, and walked out into the soft, warm rain falling from a sky webbed by cataracts of cloud.
Ah,
he said, stripping to his breeches and letting the rain wash some of the smell of the tattered crimson from his skin. It was strange, he reflected, how the myriad stinks of the poison orchid had become familiar, and the smell of the sort of places he'd spent years in had become intrusive. Drakasha had shifted the orchid to a position just off one of the long stone piers in the hospital anchorage, and Locke saw that a dozen small boats had come up along the larboard side. While 5 or 6 armed blue watch held the entry port, Utgar and Zamira were negotiating vigorously with a man standing atop a launch filled with pineapples. The early afternoon was consumed by the coming and going of boats. Assorted prodigals appeared offering to sell everything from fresh food to alchemical drugs, while representatives from the independent traders came to inquire about the goods in the hold and view samples under Drakasha's watchful eye. The orchid temporarily became a floating market square. Around the second hour of the afternoon, just as the rain was abating and the sun burning through the clouds above, the red messenger appeared out of the trader's gate passage and dropped anchor beside the orchid. Nazreen, Gwillem, and the prize crew came back aboard, along with several of the ex-messengers who'd recovered enough to move around.
"What the hell is he doing here?" one of them hollered when he saw Locke.
"Come with me," said Jabril, putting an arm around the man's shoulder. "Nothing I can't explain. And while I'm at it, I'll tell you about a thing called the Scrub Watch."
Scholar Tregan ordered a boat lowered so she could visit the messenger and examine the injured still aboard her. Locke helped hoist the smallest boat down, and while he was doing so, Tregan crossed paths with Gwillem at the entry port.
"We've traded cabins," she said gruffly. "I've got your old compartment, and you can have mine."
"What?
What?
Why?"
"You'll find out soon enough."
Before the Vadran could ask any more questions, Tregan had clambered over the side and Zamira had taken him by the arm.
"What sort of bid will the shipbreaker open with for her?"
2 silvers and a cup of cowpox, Scabs," said Gwillem.
"Yes, but what can I reasonably talk him up to?"
1100 or 1200 solari. He's going to need 2 new topgallant masts, as the 4 was sprung as well. It just didn't come down. New yards, some new sails. She's had work done recently, and that's a help. But a look at her timbers will show her age. She's got maybe 10 years of use left in her."
"Captain Drakasha?"
said Locke, stepping up beside Gwillem, if I may be so bold. This scheme you were talking about, Ravel? I'm sure I can squeeze at least a few hundred more solari out of him.
Ravel? Gwillem frowned at him. Ravel, the former captain of the Red Messenger?
Delighted to meet you, said Locke. And all I need to borrow, Captain, are some better clothes, a few leather satchels, and a pile of coins.
What?
Relax, I'm not going to spend them. I just need them for show. And you'd better let me have Jerome as well.
Captain, said Gwillem, why is Orin Ravel alive and a member of the crew and asking you for money?
Del, hollered Drakasha.
Right here,
she said, appearing a moment later.
Del, take Gwillem aside and explain to him why Orin Ravel is alive and a member of the crew. But why is he asking you for money? Said Gwillem.
Ezri grabbed him by the arm and pulled him away.
My people expect to be paid for the messenger, said Drakasha. I need to be sure whatever you're scheming won't actually make things worse.
Captain, in this matter, I'd be acting as a member of your crew. Lest you forget, I have a share of what we get for the messenger, too.
Hmm.
She looked around and tapped her fingers on the hilt of one of her sabers. Better clothes, you say? 10. The shipbreaker's agents, primed by rumors from the night before, were swift to spot the new sail in Prodigal Bay. At the fifth hour of the afternoon, an ornate barge rowed by banks of slaves pulled alongside the Red Messenger. Drakasha waited to receive the occupants of the barge with Delmastro, Gwillem, and 24 armed crewfolk. First up the side was a squad of guards, men and women sweating beneath armor of boiled leather and chain. Once they'd swept the deck with their eyes, a team of slaves leapt aboard and rigged lines to haul a hanging chair from barge to ship. Sweating furiously, they strained to heave this chair and its occupant up to the entry port. The shipbreaker was exactly as Drakasha remembered, an old paper-skinned Therin so distended with fat that it looked as though he'd popped his seams and his viscous flesh was pouring out into the world around him. His jowls ended somewhere below the middle of his neck, his fingers were like burst sausages, and his wattles had so little firmament behind them they quivered when he blinked. He managed to rise from his chair with the help of a slave at either hand, but he didn't look remotely comfortable until another slave produced a wide lacquered shelf, a sort of portable table. This was set before him, and he heaved his massive belly atop it with a groan of relief.
A limping brig, he said to no one in particular. One t'gallant mast gone, and the other one fit for firewood. Somewhat aged. A lady whose fading charms are ill-concealed by recent layers of paint and gilt. Oh, forgive me, Zamira, I did not see you standing there.
Whereas I felt the ship heel over the instant you came aboard, said Drakasha. She was tough enough to pull through a summer's-end storm even in the hands of an incompetent. Her lines are clean, topgallant masts are cheap, and she's sweeter by far than most of the heaps you haul to the east.
Heaps procured for me by captains like yourself. Now, I want to peek under her breeches and see if she has any quim left to speak of. Then we can discuss the size of the favour I'll be doing you.
Pose all you like, old man. I'll have a fair price for a fair ship. Fair she is, said Leocanto Costa, choosing that moment to emerge from his lurking place within the companionway. The orchid's little store of fine clothing had furnished him with a veneer of wealth. His mustard-brown coat had cloth of silver cuffs, his tunic was unstained silk, his breeches were passable, and his shoes were polished. They were also large enough for a man of Jerome's build, but Costa had stuffed them with rags to help them fit. One couldn't have everything. A borrowed rapier hung from his belt, and several of Zamira's rings gleamed on his fingers. Behind him came Jerome, dressed as the dutiful manservant of common demeanour, carrying three heavy leather satchels over his shoulder. The speed with which they'd assumed these roles led Zamira to infer they'd used them elsewhere.
"My lord," said Drakasha, "have you finished your inspection?"
"I have, and, as I said, fair. Not excellent, but hardly a death trap. I can see 15 years in her with a bit of luck."
"Who the fuck might you be?"
The shipbreaker regarded Costa with eyes like a bird suddenly confronted by a rival's beak just as it's about to seize a worm.
"Tavrin Callus," said Costa. "Lashane."
"Appear?"
asked the shipbreaker. "Of the third. You don't need to use my title."
"Nor will I. Why are you sniffing around this ship?"
"Your skull must be softer than your belly. I'm angling to buy her from Captain Drakasha."
"I am the one who buys ships in Prodigal Bay."
"By what? The writ of the gods? I'm in funds, and that's all that signifies."
"Your funds won't help you swim, boy."
"Enough," said Drakasha. "Until one of you pays for it, this is my ship you're standing on."
"You're very far from home, pup, and you cross me at your..."
"You want this ship, you pay full weight of metal for it." Drakasha seethed, her irritation genuine. The shipbreaker was powerful and useful, but in a contest of sheer force, any brass sea captain could crush him beneath their heel. Lack of competition led him to presume too much upon the patience of others.
"If Lord Callus tenders the best offer, I'll take it from him. Are we through being foolish?"
"I'm prepared to buy my ship," said Costa.
"Now hold it, Captain," said Del Mastro on cue. "We know the shipbreaker can pay, but we've yet to see the lordship's coin."
"Del's right," said Drakasha. "We use letters of credit to wipe our asses down here, Lord Callus. You'd best have something heavy in those bags."
"Of course," said Costa, snapping his fingers.
Jerome stepped forward and dropped one satchel on the deck at Drakasha's feet. It landed with a jangling clink.
"Gwillem," she said, motioning him forward.
He crouched over the satchel, unbound its clasps, and revealed a pile of gold coins. In actuality, a combination of Zamira's ship's purse and the funds Leocanto and Jerome had brought to sea. Gwillem lifted one, held it up to the sunlight, scratched it, and bit it. He nodded.
"The real thing, Captain. Tal Varar Solari."
700 in that bag," said Costa, which was the cue for Jerome to throw the second one down on the deck beside it.
700 more."
Gwillem unclasped the second satchel, allowing the shipbreaker to see that it too was apparently brimming with gold. At least it was for 5 or 6 layers of Solari above a silk pocket filled with silvers and coppers. The third satchel was as much a sham, but Zamira hoped that Costa wouldn't have to make his point again.
"And from that," said Leocanto, "I'll give you 1,000 to commence."
"The edges of his coins could be shaved," said the shipbreaker. "This is intolerable, Drakasha. Bring scales from your ship, and I'll have mine fetched up."
"These coins are pristine," said Costa, gritting his teeth. "Every last one. I know you'll check them, Captain, and I know what my life would be worth if you found any of them debased."
"But..."
"Your deep concern for my welfare is noted, shipbreaker," said Drakasha. "But Lord Callus is entirely correct, and I judge him sincere. He offers 1,000. Do you wish to better that?"
"Legs are open, old man," said Leocanto. "Can you really get it up?"
1,010, said the shipbreaker.
1,100, said Costa. "Gods, I feel like I'm playing cards with my stable hands."
1,100, wheezed the shipbreaker, "and 50.
1,200.
I have yet to examine her timbers.
Then you should have hauled yourself across the bay faster. 1,200.
13.
That's the spirit, said Costa. Pretend you can keep up with me. 1,400.
15, said the shipbreaker. I warn you, Callus, if you push this price higher, there will be consequences.
Poor old lard bucket, forced to make do with a merely ridiculous profit rather than an obscene one. 1,600.
Where did you come from, Callus?
Booked passage on an independent trader.
Which one?
None of your God's damned business. I'm good for 16. What a...
18,
hissed the shipbreaker.
Are you running out of purses, you Lashani pretender?
19, said Costa, injecting a note of concern into his voice for the first time.
2,000 solari.
Leocanto made a show of conferring briefly with Jerome. He looked down at his feet, muttered, "Fuck you, old man," and gestured for Jerome to collect the satchels from the deck. "To the shipbreaker," said Zamira, suppressing a huge smile, "for 2,000.
Ha!
The shipbreaker's face became contorted with triumph that looked nearly painful.
"I could buy 10 of you on a whim, whelp. If I ever felt the need to scabbard my cock in something foreign and useless."
"Well, you won," said Leocanto. "Congratulations. I'm ever so chagrined."
"You should be," said the shipbreaker, "since you're suddenly standing on my ship. Now I'd like to hear what you'll bid to keep me from having you spitted over a fire."
"Shipbreaker," said Drakasha, "until I see 2,000 solari in my hands, like all hells is this your ship."
"Ah," said the old man, "a technicality."
He clapped his hands and his slaves sent the hoist chair back to the barge, presumably to be loaded with gold. "Captain Drakasha," said Costa, "thank you for your indulgence, but I know when it's time to withdraw."
"Del," said Drakasha, "show Lord Callus and his man to one of our boats. Lord Callus, you're welcome to stay for dinner in my cabin. After that, we can send you back where you belong."
"Indebted to you, Captain." Costa bowed more deeply than strictly necessary, and then vanished through the entry port with Del Mastro and Jerome.
"Got the wet-eared little prick," said the shipbreaker loudly. "Keep his money."
"I'm content with yours," said Zamira. "Besides, I'm rather taken with the idea of having a genuine Lashani baron convinced that he owes me his life." The shipbreaker's slaves transferred bag after bag of coins to the deck of the messenger, silver and gold, until the agreed-upon price was heaped at Zamira's feet. Gwillem would count it all at leisure, of course, but Zamira felt no anxiety about fraud or debasing. The sacks would contain exactly what they were supposed to, by the logic Tavrin Callus had espoused a few minutes earlier. The shipbreaker kept a dozen well-equipped mercenaries at his fortified estate on the edge of town, but if he cheated a captain, he'd have pirates after him in platoons, and his running days were a distant memory. Drakasha left the messenger in the hands of the shipbreaker's guards and slaves, and was back aboard the Orchid within half an hour, feeling the contentment that always came with seeing a prize sold off. One less complication to plan around. Now her entire crew would be back on one hull, shares would be made, the ship's purse substantially enriched. The injured ex-messengers who hadn't been with them for the Kingfisher sacking presented a slight problem, but to a man they'd opted for the temporary indignity of the scrub watch, if the alternative was to be left in prodigal in ill health.
"Ravel, Valora,"
she said, finding the pair of them sitting in the undercastle shade, talking and grinning along with Del and a dozen crew folk.
That went better than I expected.
700 or 800 more than what we might have had otherwise, said Gwillem with surprise.
That much more fat to marble everyone's cut, said Valora.
Until the bastard spends some money to check up on the independent traders, said Del, one eyebrow raised in mingled admiration and disbelief, when he discovers that nobody's brought any Lashani noble anywhere near prodigal recently.
Of course he'll figure out what happened sooner or later. Costa waved a hand dismissively.
That's the beauty of it. That sort of uptight, self-loving, threat-making little tyrant, well, you can play him like a piece of music. Never in 1,000 years would he run around letting anyone else know that you suckered him in broad daylight with such a simple trick. And with the profit margin he scrapes out of every ship he takes from you, there's just no way in hell he'll hit back with anything but fussy words.
He's got no power to push, if pushing's what comes to his mind, said Zemira.
I call the deed well done. Doesn't mean you can lounge around in those fancy clothes all evening, though. Get them stowed again.
Of course, Captain.
And whether or not the shipbreaker bites his tongue, I think it best to keep you two out of sight for the rest of our time here. You're both confined to the ship.
What? But...
I believe, said Drakasha in an amused but firm tone of voice, that it might not be wise to let a pair such as you off the leash too frequently. I'll give you a little something extra from the ship's purse for your trouble.
Oh, fair enough.
Costa began removing the more delicate components of his fine costume. I suppose I've got no particular urge to get my throat slit in an alley anyway.
Wise lad.
Zemira turned to Del Mastro. Del, let's get a list together for tonight's merry watch. They can go ashore with us when we head in for the council. Let's say 1/2 the ship's company. Make it fair.
Right, said Del. And until we come back from that meeting, they can wait in the boats, conveniently watching for trouble, can't they?
Exactly, said Zemira. Same as all the other crews, I expect.
Captain, Del whispered almost into Zamira's ear. What the hell is this meeting about?
Bad business, Ezri. She glanced at Leocanto and Jerome, smiling and joking with one another, oblivious of her scrutiny.
Bad if it's true, bad if it's not.
She put an arm on Ezri's shoulder. This young woman who'd turned her back on life as a pampered Nikoran aristocrat, who'd risen from scrub watch to first mate, who'd nearly been killed 12 times in 1/2 that many years to keep Zamira's precious orchid afloat.
Some of the things you'll hear tonight concern Valora. I can't guess what you two have spoken of in private, in those rare interludes where you two spend your private moments speaking.
Ezri thrust out her chin, smiled, and didn't deign to blush.
But what I have to say may not please you. If there's anything to be settled between us, said Ezri softly, I trust him to settle it, and I'm not afraid to hear anything.
My Ezri, said Zemira.
Well then, let's get dressed to go meet the relations. Armor and sabers. Oil your scabbards and wet your knives. We might need the tools to make some parting arguments if the conversation goes poorly.